This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Live on Joy 94.9 Saturday afternoon from noon via the live stream at joy.org.au/listen-live or tune your wireless in Melbourne to 94.9 FM.
Use it, break it, fix it, trash it, change it, nail it, create it, change it, point it to me, press it, snap it, work it, cook it, erase it, write it, cut it, paste it, save it, load it, check it, quickly write it, plug it, play it, burn it, dip it, drag it, drop it, zip and zip it, lock it, fill it, call it, find it, view it, code it, jam and lock it, surf it, scroll it.
Good afternoon, this is Technogaze here on Joy 94.9, the show where we look into the world of consumer electronics, gadgets and technologies. I just had a bit of a brain munch then.
You just went a little bit blank too. I was like, oh no.
What do we talk about on this
Mark,
show?
Are you there, Mark? Are you there?
Maybe it's because I'm based on some DNS system.
Ah, yes. Someone's hacked into your central controller.
And the reason why I bring up DNS is that's one of the topics we'll be talking about today.
Nice segue there, Mark.
I know, right? Like, how did I work that in? No one noticed at all. What else are we talking about today? We're going to talk a bit about. We're heading into scientific territory briefly with TEDx speaker Marcus Dorr from Mineral Carbonation International. He joins us on the phone to talk about alternatives to carbon sequestration. For carbon capture.
That sounds very cool. I'm looking forward to that.
Mm. And we'll also be talking about crowdfunding later on in the show with some recent changes locally that may bring it to the fore here in Australia. And we can't have the show go by without... It is the last show before it's election day, right? So...
Yes.
Technogaze, we've tried to steer clear of election coverage, but...
I dragged it in, kicking and screaming by its hair today.
I wouldn't blame you. It's an important topic and we should think about it from the technology...
I just think, like, compared with the last election where the NBN was quite a big topic, there hasn't been that much tech coverage and we've got a bit to say, so...
I
beat Mark up a bit and said, we've got to talk about the election, so if you tune out because of that, you can blame me. I'm sorry. Tune out, though. Stay. It's going to be awesome.
Do stay tuned for that topic because it will give you some information on how to assist in yourself in making the decision you want to make when you're filling out your, say, your Senate paper, which is going to
be an informed citizen.
That's right. It's going to be a very long process to fill out, what, 90-odd boxes?
97 choices for the Senate in Victoria.
Mm. Assuming you vote below the line there.
Yes.
So we've got some ideas on how to make that a little easier for you. But without any further ado, let's get on to it. The domain name system. Now, a couple of wide-reaching failures have been reported over the past week or two in DNS, which has had a pretty big effect on the internet and, well, its basic function of actually working,
the
right?
The DNS is like an intrinsic part of the internet. Like, for those of you who don't know, it's a hierarchical distributed naming system for computers, services, or any resource connected to the internet or a private network. That's what Wikipedia says.
But I was going to say, that sounds very Wikipedia-ish.
It's very Wikipedia. I did highlight a printout there. But like, what it really means is it's a massive address book. It translates, you know, the numbers of the internet, which computers really, that's all they actually understand. So, you know, it translates 117.53.163.91 into joy.org.au, which is, you know, something that humans can understand and possibly remember.
Because you can actually type that number into your web browser, right? And it'll send you to the Joy website.
It should do.
The whole point of DNS is to say, instead of having to worry about numbers, I can just type in that address.
Domain name system is what DNS stands for. But the thing about the domain name system, we all rely on it. We never think about it. There are these massive, there are core domain name servers around the world that do all of that addressing, and they send all of our traffic where it needs to go, like big postal data collection centers. Except it's all digital, you know, stuff that you never see or don't really you know, we never think about this stuff.
But the flashing lights.
The flashing lights. But this has become one of the strange weak points, I guess, on the internet. And it's where increasingly we're seeing sophisticated attacks bring down things like the New York Times last week. And this was credited to the Syrian Electronic Army.
Who
brought that down. And they're actually responsible for a few of these kinds of hacks in recent times.
So that particular attack you're talking about, it happened just this week, and it actually involved a local company, Melbourne IT, in the attack vector, as in, I think... So one of the other complex things about the DNS system is the way that... you know, in order for me to purchase a domain name myself, I can go to any number of registrars or resellers of registrars.
So how was Melbourne IT involved in this?
So Melbourne IT have some, I understand they have some root servers. So they own some of the, like the main big servers that know everything about anything about, you know, these
numbers
these
and names.
And they're considered a registrar, I believe. And then resellers are people who, you know, obviously have access, you know, the ability to sell these domain names through Melbourne IT as a sort of a second party there. So the idea is that I think what happened here, in fact, was one of the resellers of Melbourne IT's got hacked or had their passwords hacked.
So one of those kind of subsidiaries had some kind of weakness.
And it just so happens that the New York Times, which is the domain name that went bust, actually was one of the, you know, was managed by this particular password or that sort of thing. That's the way I read the article anyway. I mean,
wow.
It's a funny thing when all this kind of stuff goes on. There's a lot of sort of non-information in a lot of the news stories.
Yeah, there's,
you know,
a lot of kind of running around with hair on fire and arms in the air, but not a lot of detail or facts or real kind of data on what happened, to whom and why.
And, you know, that kind of, I don't blame them necessarily for that, because you can't expect a corporate entity to divulge everything about their security systems and so forth. And where the weaknesses are.
Well, you know, and that DNS is one of them. So I heard, you know, I think just really speculation. There was also an outage at Google last week.
Yes.
Which all of Google, like everything at Google, went down for between 1 and 5 minutes.
So we're talking Google.com.
Google.com, right? And associated, all of the associated Google-ness, like docs and mail.
It's a general vibe. It's a thing. It's a cloud.
The Google-ness. And, you know, it went out for 5 minutes. And the kind of striking thing there is apparently there was a downward spike in all internet traffic of 40%. During that 5 minutes of no Google, which is kind of mind-boggling when you think about it, how reliant we have become on Google. So there's only speculation that DNS was involved in that, but, you know, can we? You know, we've kind of got to this point where we're using these technologies like we use air. We don't think about it. It's there. We breathe it in. We breathe it out. And then suddenly there's none there and we're like, I can't breathe.
Well, to do the preparation for this very show, we rely on a lot of Google services ourselves.
Yes. Hi, NSA. Come read all about our show.
Yeah, well, we talk about most of the stuff we type up anyway, so...
Yeah, there's no big secrets here.
I can imagine Techno Gaze secret club. We should start that.
You can join. You can find us on Twitter. It is our secret lair, TechnoGaze.
That's the password, right?
Oh, is that? Oh, I said the wrong thing. I fail. All right, sorry.
Good segue there, because if you have anything to say during the course of this show, we're, of course, looking at email and we're looking at Twitters. The ability to do that is via email at, I've screwed that up. What is it? onair@joy.org.au, apparently.
Yes.
I should know this
by actually, now. I've just like glanced at our screen. I see that there is an email from our fabulous colleague, Raina, who's said that there's no mat, therefore there must have been no studio dance off.
This is true.
Usually, for those of you who can't see into the secret lair of the studio, during our theme music, then we're often found boogieing to our opening music because it's so... It's just, you know, it's danceable, right?
A bit boppy,
it's
right?
Anyway, I digress.
So there's other ways you can contact us in a similar way to what Raina did. You can also tweet us at Technogaze, TechnoGaze, and you can call us if you wish to speak to someone here at Joy. Joy's phone number is 1300 JOY 949.
I didn't know that.
They can take your message and pass it in to us as well. You're listening to Joy 94.9. We'll have some. We'll be back in a few moments with an interview with Marcus Storr. You're listening to Joy 94.9, and we're about to head into scientific territory. So I have with me in the studio our resident scientist, Craig. Welcome, Craig.
Hello.
Now, about a week ago, in an article caught my attention on the ABC website about carbon capture technology. We've heard a fair bit about carbon capture and how it can be a way to reduce our carbon footprint on a worldwide scale. However, a lot of the discussion is around sequestration. The ABC article proposed an alternative technology being developed that actually refers to capturing carbon in a solid form. And it specifically referred to some work being done by Marcus Storr from Mineral Carbonation International. Marcus joins us on the phone right now. Thank you for joining us today, Marcus.
Thank you for having me on.
Now, I'll start with an easy one because I'm not really the scientific-minded person that I am.
Yes.
Mineral carbonation, what is it?
So mineral carbonation is really about taking what is the Earth's own process of taking atmospheric carbon out and putting it into rock. And it does it over geological time. And mineral carbonation, for us, is speeding that process up and putting it into rock. But the rock we're actually making is called carbonate. It's a type of a rock that's already in the Earth's crust, very abundant. And we're actually proposing to use that for bricks and pavers and the built environment. So you could actually see it as taking CO2 and putting it into much more usable materials.
Right. Now, of the ways that carbon mineralisation can be done, some of them aren't necessarily viable. Now, what gives the one that you're looking towards the advantage on that?
Well, we looked at lots of different forms of mineral carbonation, but also actually what could be done with CO2. So we actually started from that point of, well, what could we do with it? And we took a scientific approach to this and said, well, what are all the possible things could be done? Mineral carbonation is very high up there in terms of its potential, and also it's already favourable thermodynamically. So physics actually supports us to do this transformation. But what we actually look for is, well, what kind of rocks do we need to find to be able to do this process? And then we've worked 6 years on that particular approach.
So, Marcus,
to where we are now.
I understand that so some of these processes are actually not really carbon neutral, or actually they put out more carbon dioxide than what they actually put in.
Yep.
How does your method fit with all that? Does it actually end up, you know, putting more carbon into materials than it does putting it into the atmosphere?
No. So what we end up doing, the end materials, so firstly our main process has a energy penalty, absolutely. So it will cost us a certain amount of energy to do it. But, you know, nothing's cheaper than putting CO2 in the atmosphere. So if we want to stop doing that, then there's going to be a price of some sort to the alternative. We're trying to get that as low as possible. But the materials we're producing won't be subsequently fired, and the carbon will still be stored in the material into the carbonates. So it's an end store for the carbon. The carbon doesn't go any further than where it's then stored. It's permanent.
Right. Now, I've actually seen your TEDx video, and you talk sort of more on a global scale. I guess it's the focus is definitely from your perspective. I mean, you identify yourself as being an entrepreneur, right?
So that's right.
But you are looking at it from a global perspective.
Absolutely. Well, we're our group is basically looking at it as an industry ecology. So, you know, kind of the lead thinkers in this are around industrial ecology, around new forms of energy. So how does this fit in with, say, a reduced fossil fuel usage in the world? And thinking forward to a 2030, kind of 2020 to 2030 timeframe, that's where we're really looking at, when we will need to put away large amounts of CO2. We're absolutely sure we will have to.
Right. So I guess there's a lot of talk also about renewables and how renewable energy plays into the carbon debate, for want of a better word. Does it sort of, do you see this as being complementary to what you're working on? Or?
Absolutely. I mean, anyone rationally thinking about, you know, the energy debate is thinking about both security but also the mix. And it's all about what kind of mix do we desire, what can we achieve. And, you know, let's hope we're not using many fossils, you know, in the 2050 timeframe. Let's hope we've moved them all to either being non-emitting at all or we've totally replaced them. I mean, that's really the aim, is to get to zero emissions.
Is mining performed as part of the process here to create the carbon?
We need rock. So we need the rocks that we're looking at. But we didn't have a eureka moment with this technology. What we did was said, if it were to be a large-scale solution, what would it need to be? And around the mining operation, the mines wouldn't compete with farming land, for example. Mm-hmm. They'd have to be abundant. They'd have to be low value, but also low cost to mine. So the kind of mining operation that to get the minerals we're looking at is a kind of quarry operation. We'd be quarrying the minerals. We then put the CO2 into it through a series of processes, and then most of it goes back in to fill that particular quarry. So we're actually carbonating a set of rocks, effectively, a group of rocks.
Right. Now, the carbon footprint as a whole, then, I mean, it's I know you talk a bit about the needing to keep it as low as possible. Is it something that you've got to a point where it's
economical?
Yeah.
So again, by standard economics, we've done a pre-feasibility on a large scale, and we could do it for around about $70 a ton now without a ton of CO2. So for a ton of CO2, we can get rid of it through mineral carbonation for $70 a ton. But we have many themes that we're following, including some elegant design around our plant and things like that, that could, each individual theme could bring down that cost substantially. And already with our industrial partner, with Orica, they've already informed us of, you know, some of our calculations were overestimated. So the price could even come down further.
Right.
But we're aiming for something very low, where you have something like a carbon price of, say, you know, $30 or $40 a ton. We would hope to play in that sphere then. So if the carbon price were that, then we would be, you know, in the zone to be able to store and sink away that much CO2.
Now, can you tell us a bit about your organisation? I mean, you mentioned partnerships with other companies.
Yeah.
I understand you've obtained government funding as well.
That's right.
To facilitate the work. What does that actually achieve for you? What are you spending that money on?
So we're spending it on some further science, some more fundamental science to bring these individual themes down. So each individual scientific theme could, you know, substantially reduce our cost, but also to experiment and to, in fact, produce enough of this carbonate to give to other companies, you know, other Australian companies typically, that could formulate new products, which indeed would spur on a new sector of building materials.
So, Marcus, you've talked a lot about how all of this is scientifically favourable and all of that stuff. How closely do you work with academics and scientists with this process?
My team is absolutely full of professors and geologists and basically chemical engineers.
All the right brains to...
I'm just the cat herder. So really, the entrepreneurial spark for this came out of Canberra, out of where I live, Really asking that question, what could be done with CO2? So I really, I was matched with some smart professors and, over the course of 6 years, we've formulated, and indeed there's been an international resurgence in this mineral carbonation area as each government realises that they need to have something more on offer than just geological storage, which is, geosequestration,
right,
the standard CCS. So this is very complementary.
Would you say the industry as a whole, there's a bit of a push for research, definitely in the carbon capture area.
Mm.
What would you say that industry is like? Is it a competitive industry? Is it somewhere that, you're competing with others, or is it more of a, collaborative affair?
It's becoming competitive. There's a lot of pre-competitive information, a lot of good sharing. Cooperative research centres have developed all that initial technology, all pre-competitive. But now, at the end of the where they're starting to implement, it's starting to become competitive. Ours is in the competitive area. I mean, we have set this up to if we succeed in our goals, we want this to be an Australian technology, and we want it to be recognised as an Australian technology.
Mm, right.
So, there's a fair road ahead. This is a 4-year program. After the second, into year 2.5, we will be producing the carbonates, and then we'll be giving those out. Then we'll be running that for a year, and then the final part of our project is to scale a design up so that we could actually take it to, into New South Wales or any other place around the world that would be suitable.
Right.
So, Marcus, how many takers have you had for the carbonate? So how are you, who's going to use that in, because it's a building material, isn't
That's
it?
That's right. So we've already talked to some building industry companies. I won't name them. We're under kind of a NDA with them. But they are the big boys. But we've also got some boutique companies that have expressed an interest as well. So, look, we are agnostic. We would like to actually, encourage further innovation around the use of the carbonate. So we think there's a whole lot of opportunities to use carbonates in a variety of industrial or built environment environments.
Right. Now, we've talked to sort of broadly about the materials. I mean, what is the actual output? What sort of things are you looking to actually produce as part of the end result?
So what we ultimately produce is magnesium carbonate, and people can go and look up that what a magnesium carbonate looks like. It comes in various forms, but we will be producing something similar in looking and in material to gypsum or like what you know as gyprock,
right,
or plasterboard. So there's certainly those applications, but also compressed bricks and pavers. That's another one. And indeed, we've produced some of those, and at our launch, we had some of those on show to show you what it would look like. They're lightweight, they've got they're fire retardant, they're quite interesting material.
Right. So for our listener at home, if there is anything, if you're interested in the topic, I guess you've actually done a TEDx talk yourself.
That's right.
On this particular topic, in probably more broad terms than what we've talked about today. But
yeah,
it covers quite well the broader aspect of it, particularly on a worldwide sort of look at things.
Yep.
Yeah, thank you for joining us today, Marcus.
Thanks very much for having me. And, I think it's an exciting technology for Australia, with the challenges we have ahead with climate change.
Sounds definitely like an interesting area that we wish you all the rock in the world in success.
Thanks.
We'll definitely keep an eye on work as it progresses as well.
Great.
So thank you very much, Marcus.
Thanks very much.
That was Marcus Dorr from Minerals Carbonate International. If you're looking for his TEDx talk on carbon capture, we've just posted the address on our Twitter feed, twitter.com/technogaze. Thank you, Craig, for joining me for this interview.
Thank you for having me.
No worries.
Joy 94.9.
Technogaze.
We're covering some of the latest in tech news, and something that that we came to realise this week was the worldwide, or it's a crowdfunding site that is known worldwide.
Oh, that's
anyway.
Right. Kickstarter is coming to Australia.
Yes.
So Kickstarter, for those who don't know, is a crowdfunding platform where you can put up a great idea and have a bunch of people give you money to make that idea come to life. Mm. Now, I was a bit confused, actually, by the big announcement that you know, Kickstarter's coming to Australia? Because I, you know, I was under the impression that it was already here. They've already been program, you know, Australian projects on Kickstarter. So I'm not kind of sure what's new and different here.
Yeah, it's almost like they've just decided to do a PR spin.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, and it's also there's a homegrown crowdfunding platform called Possible,
right?
And they kind of, you know, self-describe themselves as not only a crowdfunding platform but a community building tool for creative projects and ideas. And there's a few different you know, the I think there's some differences between them, but I've never been really quite sure on what those differences are.
Yeah, because we did a bit of a roundup while we were preparing for the show, didn't we, of other crowdsourcing. I mean, that's a generic term, right? Crowdsourcing is
crowdsourcing,
sort of
crowdfunding. Yeah, and there are a few of them around now, and I think, you know, we found some kind of top 10 crowdfunding website thing sort of stuff. So, you know, it's not new. So what's new here is that Kickstarter are saying, no, we're going to come directly to the Australian market with kickstarter.com/Australia.
So there's other ones like Rocket Hub.
GoFundMe. Not really heard much about those ones, so I saw them in the list. And you know, Rocket Hub, what's the other one? GoFundMe.
Yeah.
But Possible is one that I've definitely heard of, and is big in Australia. And there's another one which is Indiegogo.
Yeah, and they do have their own sort of niches, I guess, because the concept is crowdfunding, as in, you know, I'm just going to put this idea out here and people are going to sign up and give me money on the basis of that idea, and perhaps as part of it, I'll give you a product at the end of it. I think we're talking before, you've actually signed up to a crowdfunded project, right?
So one that I committed to was to build a documentary about the linotype machine. This is like, you know, pre-digital technology of, you know, a printing press kind of technology, and it's now completely obsolete, and these amazing huge machines are kind of being junked, or have been junked all around the world, and they're now quite rare. And these guys in America wanted to do, you know, a documentary about it. And so they put their project up on Kickstarter and, you know, said, this is what we want to cover. And they had some, you know, beginning footage that they kind of, you know, were illustrating what they wanted to talk about. And video is a big part of it.
Yep.
And, you know, then down the track, I'd get updates. And then finally, I ended up with a DVD of the documentary in my mail as they, you know, successfully completed their project.
And that's sort of it's a really good example of a crowdfunded project where it's a very niche-y type thing, like not everyday people would be interested
because
in it, but it is a way of getting it out on the internet, right? And people
absolutely, and finding its niche. I mean, that's the great, you know, that's the big thing about the internet is, you know, we can connect with these tiny niches all around the world. You know, that we may not locally have a community of interest around what you know floats our boats, but you know, once we connect to the internet, then there's literally thousands of people around the world who share those interests.
And it can be as broad as, like, the example, you know, DVDs created, a documentary created, or it could be music related. It could be, you know, funding a particular project that someone's working on in that sense. What else can it be? Like, I guess software plays a role there.
You know, I mean, there's some interesting crowdfunding initiatives building up around software, particularly in open source. So open source has traditionally been done by people in their spare time or as a hobby. It's increasingly being done by people, you know, who are employed, but some of them want to kind of work on particular projects but don't have a job. And so there's one site which is called GitTip.
Yep.
Is, you know, where people can actually contribute very small amounts of money, like 25 cents a week, to a particular developer so that they can keep focusing on that open source software.
Yeah, right. And of course, the other examples are actual products that are being sort of...
Right. So there was like an actual failure of one, I think. Mark Pesci, who's an Australian, you know, technology commentator and futurist and stuff, and he started a project to build something called Light, and he put that on Kickstarter, and it actually wasn't successful. But he's since gone on, you know, got a lot of support, and since gone on to create other projects, which we've actually spoken about on this show before, which was the holiday programmable fairy lights kind of project.
Yes, yes.
You know, but that came out of his failure on Kickstarter.
Right. So it's definitely, I guess now that Kickstarter, if they're going to start marketing themselves in Australia, it will put a bit more sort of put the idea out there at least, which
I think that's interesting. I mean, I hope it doesn't impact negatively on, you know, the existing Australian players like Possible.com who've, you know, enabled some fantastic things themselves. But, you know, I actually think this is a great, you know, a great movement, I guess, of, you know, democratizing, you know, projects and funding for projects that, you know, doesn't necessarily have to be about getting venture capital or getting a bank to sign up to your idea.
Yeah.
If your idea is good enough and you can get enough publicity around it, anyone can build their dreams.
And of course, being a person that might sign up to one of these projects, you're essentially taking on a risk.
You do. And the risk, I mean, it's interesting, the sites kind of manage that risk for you. If the project doesn't get up, you don't pay anything.
Okay. Because there's usually some sort of threshold system, right?
Right.
Like they say,
I need $10,000 to do this. If they don't reach their goal, your money doesn't go in.
Yeah.
If they do reach their goal, though, then there's actually no guarantee you'll get the product that you signed up for.
Right.
You've just made it possible for them to go ahead.
Yep.
If they fail, they still fail. And I think that's one of the areas where the Australian watchdog system, have actually had some concerns about this, because people are investing in this and there are none of the normal fiduciary controls for what happens to that money. You have no right, no guarantee that you're actually going to see anything for it. So there's a bit of a dark side there as well. But I think, you know, people put money on things like, you know, gamble on the horses and they get no guarantee of a return there. So, you know, at least this is perhaps funding some kind of creative endeavour.
Yes, that's true. And, you know, it puts some bright minds to work as well.
I mean,
it's a way for people to express themselves and express ideas, right?
Exactly. It's a way for people to express ideas, bring them to life, and it's a way for other people to participate in that. You know, this kind of participatory, you know, spreading the load, this, you know, I said it before, the democratization of funding these kinds of ventures. Speaking of democratization.
Yes. We are in a democracy here.
We are in a democracy,
aren't we?
And we have our great moment. Democracy sausage next weekend. I think secretly that might be my favourite bit of the election, the sausage sizzle at the local primary school.
Yeah, it's usually my breakfast.
It's your breakfast. Well, you know, that's the thing, your big night, election eve, and then off you go and fill in some numbers in some boxes. And look, I did want to bring the election into the studio today because it's kind of concerned me that there hasn't been much in the way of sophisticated commentary out there on, you know, where technology, you know, lies in the policy spectrum for this election. I think last time there was a lot of stuff about the NBN and there was a very clear choice because one party was saying we're going to build the NBN,
the
National Broadband Network, and the other party was going, NBN, we don't need no stinking NBN. And that's changed since. You know, now the coalition are actually supporting a different version of the NBN. But there's a whole bunch more kind of techno spectrum stuff happening.
Yeah,
and
you think at the government level, like, you know, government spying and
right,
PRISM
surveillance and PRISM, which we've covered before.
Yeah.
But the thing that I think is really interesting, I mean, there's a bunch of new parties in this. There's a bunch of new parties in this election. So we've heard about the, you know, Clive Palmer United Party and Bob Katter's Australia Party. I don't think we've heard as much about WikiLeaks Party and also the Pirate Party. Now, what I think is interesting about those two is they actually have technology at their core, and they're talking about things like surveillance. They're talking about things like copyright. They're talking about
a broad range of things, and I think that's the point, right? Like we want to draw attention to those, you know, in a technological sense,
right,
being the purview of our show,
right? But they're just ones of many, and we also have Below the Line.
Yes, which we will talk about in just a few moments. You're listening to TechnoGaze here on Joy 94.9. Where we're covering technology and the election, of course, is coming up next week here in Australia.
Yes.
You know, we have a choice to make around, you know, obviously the major parties, but also some of the minor parties that haven't really gotten much coverage in this election cycle.
The choice is kind of interesting. I mean, you know, we have two choices to make on election day. There's our vote in the lower house, which forms government, and our vote in the upper house or the Senate, which, you know, is the supposed house of checks and balances, house of review. And there in Victoria, where, you know, the home of TechnoGaze and Joy 94.9, 1949, there are 97 candidates on the paper for the Senate.
Yes.
And most people, you know, and I don't blame you, most people will just vote one above the line. You just choose the party, and whatever their preference choices were, that's what you're going to get.
Yes.
Whether or not you've done your homework on what those preferences are and you like some years ago, I actually voted above the line and I chose vote one, and we ended up with the preferences for that party ended up flowing in a way which horrified me.
Right.
And so at that point in time, I decided, never again, I'm voting below the line. Now, back then, we didn't have belowtheline.org.au,
yes,
which is a great website where you can go and actually see all the candidates in advance and drag them around and, you know, make your choices. Mm. But it's still hard to know, well, what does the Australian Fishing and Shooting Party actually stand for, and do I approve?
What's the difference between them and what was the other one? The Australian Fishing and Lifestyle?
Or something. Why haven't they merged? I don't know. I haven't got to the difference, their key sort of differences.
Yeah.
But one of the most awesome websites out there to help you make this, you know, critical decision. I know some of you don't think elections are interesting, but I do. Remember your democracy sausage. is preferences.theglobalmail.org actually has this awesome visualization of how everyone, all the parties, have assigned their preferences.
Now, you showed this to me just before the show, didn't you? And I was like, wow, that is exactly what I need. I mean, you can do so much research into each individual party, right? Like, you can copy and paste the party's name into Google or somewhere and try to find their website, and hopefully it brings up some sort of easy to find policy document or something that they can, you know, that you can sort
right.
of work yourself out.
But
on.
This kind of makes it really visual, and you can see that when you shift, you know, look at the Coalition's preferences versus the Greens' preferences versus Labor's preferences, and the whole thing kind of jiggles around and moves, and you know, and the preferences are reordered.
And the example you used was when we looked at the Australian Labor Party, what their preferences are, and then swapped it to the Greens. And it was, you know, when you went for Greens, I think, in the Senate here, and if you did that above the line, their first preference goes to Labor.
WikiLeaks.
Oh, WikiLeaks, right. But it was the other way around, wasn't it,
yeah.
In fact,
so Labor was preferencing the Greens,
straight up.
And the Greens were preferencing WikiLeaks, and you know, then you kind of flip it around, and if you look at where One Nation's preferences are going, and you know, once you kind of go through and look at them, you get this sense of, you know, the spectrum of the spectrum of where people's kind of political leanings are, you know, and where they've made their preferences. I know there's actually been some commentary about, you know, whether or not the parties have done this strategically or philosophically, and I think that's a really interesting issue.
It seems this time around, and maybe that's one of the reasons why there's so many. It's more of a strategic move. I mean, that's what I'm sort of sensing from the media coverage over it all.
Yeah, I think so.
But this is a great way.
I mean, I think that's one of the things that the Pirate Party have stood up for saying, is that we did our preference choices based on what our members suggested, or like we polled our members to say where should our preferences go.
Yep.
Whereas some of the other parties have, you know, it's been suggested that they contacted a preference consultant who got them to do it in a very strategic way, so that all of the minor parties' preferences would flow in, you know, in their best interests of winning the seat. And I saw, I think it was on Twitter, one of my followers suggested, so really what those parties who've gone strategically rather than philosophically are saying is that the means justifies the ends.
Do you remember a party, Senator Online, I think it was?
Right.
It was like they actually proposed an idea of if they got any senators into the House.
Right. And
they would actually put the vote out on a website and say, how should this senator vote?
Yes.
And have a sort of all these checks and balances built into that as well to make sure that there wasn't any sort of rorting or anything going on.
I thought that was really interesting. Like the practice of it, though, has raised some questions. You know, if they were to get on and, you know, we were to use, some kind of app on our smartphones to then, you know, feed that information back to them on our thoughts on that, but then when you go and, you know, I thought that sounded like a great idea, and then I went and looked at their preferences, and they're all kind of preferencing the Conservative parties over the Progressive parties, and I go, well, would they then really be listening to what, you know, a majority of people are telling them, or would they be going with that obvious
simply? Yeah, I guess it's a funny thing. If you look at the preferences, does that indicate how you know what they're going to be like as a party? I mean, it's more, you know, is it chicken or egg,
right?
In a way,
which is a bit scary. But yeah, I just did it then. Senator Online is a party in this election, and
they're
Greens
one of the candidates
and so forth are right down the bottom.
So I mean, I actually, if I could advocate one thing, it's have a look at the preferences.theglobalmail.org. I think that's the URL. We'll tweet it out.
Theglobalmail.org. Yeah.
Theglobalmail.org.
As in preferences. The Global Mail.
We'll tweet it. We'll put it on the show notes. But it's a great way of really getting that sense without having to trawl through the Australian Electoral Commission's, you know, multi-page PDF, which lists the preferences. This has made it really accessible. And regardless of where your political leanings fall, being informed and getting a sense of what that political spectrum actually looks like is something we should all do. I mean, you know, the informed citizen is why we have representative democracy. And if we don't, you know, get informed, if we don't make an effort, then we get what we deserve, right?
And any tool that can help us do that...
is a good tool.
Is a good tool.
We like good tools.
We're just tweeting.
Sorry, Mark.
I always went that slip by. I was like, hang on.
Yeah. One of the other ones which has been talked about, and we spoke a little bit about, is Vote Compass. We mentioned that some of the Orwellian implications of a site that collects so much political data, but it's now had over a million respondents, and it is an extraordinary, insight into how Australia is responding. And obviously there's bias there. Obviously it's a self-selected sample, which has problems. But regardless, when you've got a million responses, you've still getting some pretty interesting data out of that, and good food for thought.
Indeed. Yes, it's 7 minutes to one here on Technogaze on Joy 94.9. We've probably talked enough about the election.
Yeah, I think so.
I mean,
I'm over it.
Can go anywhere else to hear about it as well. Those websites, we're just tweeting them now. So, check out our Twitter feed, twitter.com/technogaze for the URLs. If you have anything to say, we're towards the end of the show, but if you do wish to message us, you can do so by texting us 0427JOY949 or tweeting us at technogaze, TECHNOGAZE. We'll be back with more in a few moments.
Technogaze.
This is Technogaze here on Joy 94.9. We're covering some of the latest in technology, and we're just about at the end of our tether here for the show.
We are almost out of time.
4 minutes to one.
But you've got some app you want to talk about?
Yeah, I got recommended this app. It's a bit of a cute one. You know how when you're taking... I mean, there's a whole bunch of photo apps out there these days, right?
Instagram Flickr has one now.
And they've got all sorts of filtering and, you know, what more could you really want? Phones typically have a front and back camera.
Yes.
Right.
Well, so, new ones do, yes.
Yes. And wouldn't it be a good idea when you're actually taking photos with your front and back camera to have...
I'm trying not to giggle. Sorry.
To get the reaction of the taker as well as the subject.
That's very cool. So what's it called?
It's called Front Back.
Front Back. Front Back app. And is it available for iOS and Android or...
You know, I haven't actually checked on Android.
Well, that's because it's a last minute, you know, hot off the press kind of bit of news. We'll get some more details on it later. I actually had another little thing I wanted to sneak in that I found this week, which was vaguely amusing. An infographic, 50 things a geek should know. In days of yore, it was easy to spot a geek. We were the ones inside on a sunny day indulging our unfashionable obsessions to the detriment to our social standing, it says. And it's got a whole bunch of really, like, crazy, you know, geeky science fiction popular references. And it's kind of amusing. Some of it is like, I didn't know that. Am I a bad geek?
Is it like a nerd's Tumblr or something? It's kind of... Wow.
Well, it's just this massive infographic of, you know, a whole bunch of things. I mean, like, is know how to read leet speak at normal reading speed, know how to spend Bitcoin, things
right.
like know at least 5 phrases in Klingon, know how to jailbreak an iPhone.
This infographic is all on geeksaresexy.net.
Yes, geeksaresexy.net. 50 things a geek should apparently know. You know, how to solve a Rubik's Cube. It's hilarious. We'll tweet out the link. You may be as amused as we are, or perhaps less amused because you're perhaps more sensible.
Indeed. Now, that's all we have time for today. If you missed any part of the show, including our interview with Marcus Dorr regarding alternative carbon capture technologies, or perhaps you're looking to peruse previous episodes, you can do so by browsing to joy.org.au/technogaze. We'll have today's show up there in just a couple of hours. Coming up next is Cravings with Pete Dillon, talking food. Thank you for joining me today, Donna.
You're very welcome, Mark. It was fun, as always.
It's always a pleasure having you on. Now, have a great weekend, and we'll catch you next week.
You too. Bye-bye.
Technogaze on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.